Warm weather this week. Are you on the clicker? Yeah. There you are. So this morning we're continuing our studies of Deuteronomy, and we are up to chapter 25, which has a few different instructions in it, which we'll just see whether we can find some sort of a theme throughout them all, as we have done in the past. But before we get to that, we're going to have some worship songs, and so I'll pass it over to the band and take my place. Try that.
Okay, thank you. Oh, there we are. Thank you, Ben. If everyone would like to stand up, our first song for today is Indescribable. From the highest of heights to the depths of the sea, creation's everyone. The good, I'm an oldie to start off with. Our second one is also an oldie, Hosanna. I'd tell you a joke if I knew one, but I'm afraid I don't. Thank you. our last song for now is Lord of Lords. Beholding your beauty is all that I long for. To worship you, Jesus, is my sole desire. For this very heart you have shaped for your pleasure, purpose to lift your name high. Here I Well done, everyone. You can all take a seat.
Supposed to know by that point. Well, certainly takes. I think as summer gets to us, warming up. Having a bit of a sing-song to warm up or worshipping to warm up is takes on a whole new meaning, doesn't it, really? Certainly gets warmer. So as I said before, today we're continuing our studies of Deuteronomy. So Deuteronomy 25, And before we start, let's stop and I'll repeat the Lord's Prayer from Luke chapter 11. If you'd all like to bow your heads. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, as in heaven, so in earth. Give us day by day our daily bread, and forgive us our sins, for we also forgive everyone that is indebted to us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. So, the book of Deuteronomy, the fifth book of Moses, or really the fourth book of the law. And we all know the background. We've heard it before about how it was written when the Israelites were right on the border of their promised land to enter for the second. Well, they didn't really enter it the first time, did they? But they turned up ready to go in this time on the for the second time anyway. And it's a book that was written, I guess, really is a bit of a summary by Moses. Lots of things, lots of repetition in here of earlier laws and commands and stories and things that Moses really particularly wanted to put together for the people so that they had a good, concise record of the account of their exodus from Egypt and then also and what happened to them in the wilderness. As you recall, the time in the wilderness was a real time of growth. A few weeks ago, we looked at the numbers in the Bible and we looked at the number 40. And as we know, there was 40 years of dependence by Israel on God in the wilderness as he fed them, preserved their clothes, you know, all of these things, kept them in good health throughout those times if they would only trust in him. And we saw that they did that sometimes and they didn't do it so well other times. Certainly the first group that came out of Egypt were none of them actually entered into the promised land except really Joshua and Caleb, who were from the original group. So it was a bit of it was a real almost sorting, I guess you could say, time for the young ones, which had been born in the wilderness under this new society, I guess you could say, or this dependence, 100% dependence on God, so that they could be brought up and ready as God's people to enter the land of Israel. I think it was a very significant time. And as with all things with God's plan, we don't often know what's going on. And I imagine the Israelites really probably didn't have a clue what they were doing as far as just being stuck in the wilderness 40 years, just going out every morning at dawn to pick up their manna and then picking up their quails and things like that for their evening meal. It's very interesting. You wonder whether they sort of thought, well, what are we doing here? You know, like, I'm about the age of 40, and I would tell you that 40 seems like a long time when that's all you've had. And though I dare say there's other people here that think, well, 40 isn't that long a period of time, because they've had a couple. But I think at the end of the day, you know, like, it was a substantial period, a substantial sort of time period. And it was a time I can see from studying, well, we can see from studying this, it was a time of growth, preparation time. And it kind of feels like, you know, often in our lives, we're in times of growth and preparation. And it's hard to know what's going on at the time, but you've just got to trust that God's got everything under control. With the outline here, you'll notice that being up to chapter 25, we're almost into a new portion of the book. There's three sections that we've sort of found this divided into, or to be nicely divided up into. The past, which was a bunch of stories, setting up of the rulers, all those sort of things, telling the stories. Then there was a lot of laws between chapter 5 and 26. And being that we're in chapter 25 today, we are just about through this section, which I know everybody is going to be so disappointed about. Nothing like hearing a whole lot of thou shalt and thou shalt not. But I think we've been able to find inspirational things through it as well, applications for it. And then, of course, we have the final four chapters, which is dealing with the future. We have the Song of Moses in there. And we also have the final declaration of the covenant between God and his people at the time. So I was having a look at the chapter 25, and the interesting thing about Deuteronomy and a lot of chapters in the Bible, in fact, is that quite often they were swap and change between topics. You know, you might have a couple of verses on a particular topic and then the theme completely changes. And so you can't ever just go to a chapter in the Bible and say, this is all about this particular thing. But I was wondering, really, having a look at this today, whether we might find a bit of an underlying theme that perhaps extends beyond just this chapter. And I won't sort of tell you what it is, but we'll have a look at it as we come to the end. So I guess to the things today, we have tempered justice. So justice which doesn't belittle, that maintains human dignity. But I guess one of the more popular things these days is not to have justice at all, to excuse people's actions, to, I guess, not call out something as being wrong, but perhaps, you know, and not giving it its just deserves. And I think the book of Deuteronomy speaks strongly against that stance. Certainly, even in parts of Australia, we're seeing all sorts of problems with justice not being administered properly, with rules and instructions that are just being disregarded by large portions of the community. It's quite a interesting thing to watch, and the way that the general society norms break down, or the adherence to doing what is right, becomes no longer the standard, that, yeah, the whole system really struggles under that pressure. It can only be supported if the vast majority of the people are of the same mind when it comes to what is right and what is wrong. So that's something to bear in mind as we import other ideas on these things. Duty, of course. Duty is a very important one. We'll talk about that when we get to it. Mutual respect, especially in the face of power inequality. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that it's a bit of a buzzword or a phrase in today's society. And what it's really talking about is talking about when something or someone has more power over than somebody else in a situation, and the way that those two people can relate in a moral or fair way. And so this is this mutual respect that it's talking about here. And of course, we have some honesty in trade things there as well to talk about. But let's have a look at the first one, this humane application of justice. And it's in these first three verses here, which I'll read now. If there be a controversy between men, and they come unto judgment, and the judges may judge them, then they shall justify the righteous and condemn the wicked. There's no getting out of it. If one person is right, then that needs to be upheld. Verse 2, and it shall be, if the wicked man be worthy to be beaten, that the judge shall cause him to lie down and to be beaten before his face according to this his fault by a certain number. 40 stripes he may give him and not exceed, lest if he should exceed and beat him above these with many stripes, then thy brother should seem vile unto thee. Now, interesting, isn't it? Once again, the number 40. Actually, the common practice of the Jews after this law was given was to give 39, just in case they accidentally did one too many and they didn't want to actually exceed that 40. So hence the reason why Paul in 2 Corinthians says that five times he'd received 40 stripes, save one, so 39 stripes, which is a really interesting thing that was being carried through right until Paul's day. But I did think there was something worth mentioning here, and that's dehumanization. It happens, we've seen it happen throughout history. This is what Hitler did with the Germans around people with disabilities and also to the Jews. He dehumanized them. He made them out to be you know, vermin carrying, you know, like plague carrying type people, to the point where it affected the minds of the people in the country. It affected the general civilian population. And then that sort of created the environment where enormous atrocities which were done against these groups of people. You know, they were able to then go and enact some sort of a genocide against these people because the propaganda had been there to dehumanize in the eyes of people, the general population, the Jews. And it's a horrendous thing. It's a horrible thing when we no longer see that every human being is created in the image of God and that they have their dignity and they have the right to their human dignity. And in here, we see enshrined in this particular instruction, even when you are punishing somebody, that you are to have it is to be tempered as well. You're not to actually degrade them. It's not a degrading act. It's humiliating enough, I imagine, but to the point where it becomes abuse. That is the issue here. That is really what we're talking about here. Even with these criminals, they are still human beings and they're not to be treated like, say, animals. So there's an underlying message here in this section of human dignity, even in justice. Oh, there we go. I've got the definition of dehumanization. The process of depriving a person or group of positive human qualities. And in this case, it's saying should seem vile unto thee. So basically should be dehumanized in your eyes. They don't want it to get to that state. Anyway, lot said about that first thing. Now, this is a very interesting one, this next one, this instruction. Thou shalt not muzzle the ox when he treadeth out the corn. I imagine that it would be a fairly logical thing, you would think, to actually put some sort of a muzzle on an animal that's going to go and eat all of your produce, especially if you didn't have a very big cornfield. And if it went and ate 50% of everything that you were going to need over winter, for example, then you would try and keep it from doing that. Here we have an instruction which explicitly basically says that that's not the right thing. You shall not muzzle the ox. Paul in the New Testament gives us a great, I guess, explanation of what was trying to be addressed here. And this is actually something which I would like you to keep an eye out for as we work through this chapter. The meaning behind the meaning, the reason for these things, and as I would put it, the spirit of the law, the reason why something has been put in place. Why did God choose to make this mention of, and you'll see this in the next law as well, why would he bother to mention this particular thing? Why does he care so much about oxen? Well, as 1 Corinthians 9, 9 and 10 says on the right-hand side, for it is written in the law of Moses, thou shalt not muzzle the mouth of the ox that treadeth out the corn. Doth God take care for oxen? Because that's what it appears like, right? It appears like God is actually setting down a law to say, you need to look after your oxen. That's not what he's really talking about. He's here. He's enacting a standard or a principle. And it's the principle which is the important thing here. This is a practical application of that principle. The same thing of not, you know, same with not yoking two different sized animals together or two animals of different strengths together, that sort of thing. There's a principle behind that. And this is the beauty of studying the Old Testament, is that we can look at the principles behind the instructions that were given, and we can take away from that the true meaning of what it is that God wants us to do, the heart that he wants us to have, the attitude that he wants us to have towards each other, and also in our dedication to him. As it says in verse 10, down the bottom right, or saith he it altogether for our sakes, no doubt this is written, that he that ploweth should plough in hope, and that he that thresheth in hope should be partaker of his hope. So what he's talking about is people that are serving, people that are actually they're out there doing things for their community. I mean, we're very fortunate in this church that we have so many willing contributors. But those people who are contributors in a particular, you know, task, I guess you could say, should really have the benefit of that task as well. Tempered, sure. Once again, you don't want them just going and eating everything out of the fridge, for example. But the idea being is that there is a bit of a, there is almost like not a right, but a, you know, it's almost like they've earned to be there. They've earned a bit of their dues here. 1 Timothy has the instruction from Paul to Timothy, and we could say something against about 1 Timothy 5:19, where it says, "Against an elder receive not an accusation, but before two or three witnesses." But we have spoken about that before, in regards to even talking about the George Pell and that sort of thing situation that happened in Australia here. That was a very interesting case where that was not adhered to, and it caused a big problem. Anyway, we won't talk about that today. Okay. Now, we know that there are instructions that Moses had there that God used for setting up society, for setting up the civil nation of Israel. In fact, it really, when I look at it, there was a few different sorts of laws that were given. There were doctrinal, civil, ceremonial type laws. And we, as people who look back from our position of being saved, being saved and having our salvation through Jesus Christ, have the freedom to be able to look at those laws, find the principle behind it, and take those and adapt them to our lives. Verse 5, "If brethren dwell together, and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take him to be his wife, to wife, and perform the duty of an husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. And if the man like not to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate unto the elders and say, My husband's brother refuseth to raise up unto his brother a name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak unto him. And if he stand to it and say, I do not like to take her, then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders and loose his shoe from off his foot and spit in his face and shall answer and say, So shall it be done unto that man that will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel the house of him that hath his shoe loosed." Interesting. Interesting little instruction, isn't it? And yet you consider a society where they didn't have, you know, they didn't have social security. They didn't have a welfare type system or anything like that. If somebody if the breadwinner in your family died, you were in a pretty bad way, especially if you didn't have other family to look after you. And in this situation here, when somebody has married, when a woman has married a man and that man dies, then what it's saying is that that man's brother should actually take his place. And it's interesting, if you think about it behind that, what's happened behind that, you know, I can imagine that it may be quite difficult for that woman to find another husband, for starters. But then also the underlying point here is as well that that brother also had an inheritance in Israel as well. And so it was about keeping the lineage alive for that particular family, despite the fact that hardship has happened to them. Yes, as I've written there, the third point, this was known as the part of a kinsman. And it kind of falls into a little bit of a deontological ethics type of case, where it's a duty that had to be performed by the other people in the family to look after that person who had been married into their family, that, so to make sure that they weren't destitute. Now, I thought we might just have a quick reading from Ruth. And the reason why I've got Ruth in here is because, well, can anybody think of a reason why? Well, it kind of is exactly the situation that is described, almost. We had Naomi, of course, left the nation of Israel and went off to live in Moab with her sons and her husband. The sons married daughters over there, one of which, of course, was called Ruth. And then, of course, all the men died. So Naomi and Ruth decided that they would go back to the land of Israel again. So what happened? Well, they were beggars, weren't they? They were then out collecting all of the grain that had dropped from the harvest and from the fields of the wealthy people in the area. They were destitute. They didn't have any sort of state or, you know, social welfare type system that they could rely on. They were on their own. So what's to be done for somebody like that? Well, that's where the duty of the kinsman comes in this particular case. And yet it's a bit of a funny story because Boaz, who actually ends up performing that duty, I think he was more like a cousin rather than a brother. So he wasn't directly required to do this. And so you'll see, note the shoe exchange and things like that. There's no spitting on faces or anything like that. But anyway, let's read it and just keep that law in mind that we read before while we read the excerpts from this story. This is Boaz speaking at verse 11 in chapter 3. "And now, my daughter, fear not. I will do to thee all that thou requirest, for all the city of my people doth know that thou art a virtuous woman." Oh, Proverbs 31, isn't it? Chapter 31. Who can find a virtuous woman? "And now it is true that I am thy near kinsman. Howbeit, there is a kinsman nearer than I. Tarry this night, and it shall be in the morning that if he will perform unto thee the part of a kinsman," which is what the law was talking about, "well, let him do the kinsman part. But if he will not do the part of a kinsman to thee, then will I do the part of a kinsman to thee. As the Lord liveth, lie down until the morning." Then went Boaz up to the gate and sat him down there. And behold, the kinsman of whom Boaz spake came by, unto whom he said, "Ho, such a one! Turn aside, sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit ye down here." And they sat down. And he said unto the kinsman, "Naomi, that is come again out of the country of Moab, selleth a parcel of land, which was our brother Elimelech's." Interesting, isn't it? He doesn't mention Ruth at this point. He actually mentions the fact that there is some property here. Now, if this close kinsman, who isn't actually named, which is another interesting point, he obviously, if he was really honest with himself, then he would probably say, "Well, it's not just about the land. I need to also look after this entire family." Anyway, let's keep going. From verse 4, "And I thought to advertise thee, saying, buy it before the inhabitants and before the elders of my people. If thou wilt redeem it, redeem it. But if thou wilt not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is none to redeem it beside thee, and I am after thee." And he said, "I will redeem it." So this fellow initially is happy to help out. But then we have this. "Then said Boaz, what day thou buyest the field of the hand of Naomi, thou must buy it also of Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. And the kinsman said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mar mine own inheritance. Redeem thou my right to thyself, for I cannot redeem it." Now, there's a couple of reasons why he may have refused this. A Moabite was not... the Israelites were not supposed to marry those from the kingdom of Moab, which is very interesting. And so perhaps this fellow was, I don't know, he was saying, it's not right for me to do this. Just because this fellow has gone and married, just because Naomi's son has gone and married Ruth, it doesn't mean that I should mar my own inheritance or, you know, do the wrong thing type of thing. So you've got this sort of these duties which are conflicting, I guess you could say. The duty of the kinsman to look after, but then the sort of duty or the obedience to God's instructions which kind of work against that. So, you know, it's like, what do you do? And Boaz kind of exposed that a little bit or brought that really to light when he came up with the land thing first of all. It's like, okay, well, this is not just about that you don't, this is not just about the money. This is about the fact that you don't want anything to do with this lineage. Anyway, now this was the manner in former time in Israel concerning redeeming and concerning changing. For to confirm all things, a man plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor. And this was a testimony in Israel. Interesting, isn't it? So no spitting in faces, but the shoe was still involved. So I don't know. Maybe it's something to do with that's how you walk or something. I don't know. Therefore, the kinsman said unto Boaz, buy it for thee. So he drew off his shoe. And Boaz said unto the elders and unto all the people, ye are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's at the hand of Naomi. So Boaz took Ruth, and she was his wife. And when he went in unto her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bare a son. And it just so happens that the son that Ruth bore was Obed, who was the grandfather of King David. So it's very interesting, isn't it, how despite the fact that we had these warring of duties, these laws that sort of conflicted with each other, obviously everybody who looks at this with the perfect 2020 vision of hindsight says, oh, Boaz definitely did the right thing by supporting Naomi and her family at the time. And yet, I don't know that it was that clear at the time. So the choice was there, though. What was the right thing to do? Was it the right thing to do to support the family, these people in need, to look after the relationships there? Or was it important just to say, nope, I can't touch that because that's not right? It says here that this is wrong. Well, the proof of the pudding's in the eating, isn't it? All right, that was a little bit of a sidetrack. Now, here is one which is rather interesting. When men strive together, one with another, and the wife of the one draweth near for to deliver her husband out of the hand of him that smiteth, and putteth forth her hand, and taketh him by the secrets, then thou shalt cut off her hand, thine eye shall not pity her. Not the most edifying reading, right? So, now, the interesting thing is here, I'd like you to just consider for a second, how often do you think you would find this sort of situation occurring? It's not like, it's never going to happen, right? Two guys, they're having a punch up and that sort of thing. Anyway, and the wife rushes in and does that. Like, it's just not going to happen, is it? So why, out of all of that, why would you specifically mention that? Why would you make a rule, make a law instructing that? I'm not going to answer that right now. I'm going to come back to that. But it's just, I want you to think about that. I think some people think it's time for a song. Okay, this is one of my favorite instructions, because I feel like this is very, very applicable to us in business every day. Thou shalt not have divers weights, a great and a small. Thou shalt not have in thine house divers measures, a great and a small. But thou shalt have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure shalt thou have, that thy days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. For all that do such things, and all that do unrighteously, are an abomination unto the Lord thy God. I got ChatGPT to do me a little infographic on the, or a little clip art on the left-hand side. This is what we're talking about when having diverse weights. You know, This is 1 kilogram. This is also 1 kilogram. You know, like it's a, the point is when they were measuring out barley, wheat, when they were measuring out something to sell to somebody, if your weight was a little bit lighter than, say, 1 kilo, and this person had come to buy 1 kilo of wheat, then you're effectively keeping back, you know, some of the produce. You're not giving them what they paid for. It'd be like going and buying a box of screws that has 100 screws in it, supposedly, but somebody's gone in and taken 5 of those. It's just dishonest practice, right? And the important thing there is that unless we can trust each other in our transactions, in our economy, then we won't have a healthy economy. You know, there's always a point at which somebody has to part with the money to know that the other person is going to give them the goods that they promised that they would give them. And yeah, you can have the law and you can have courts and you can have all sorts of stuff like that, but it's just not practical unless the bulk of the people are on board with this common consensus that I need to do the right thing. And not to mention as well that, you know, there's also, and a lot of the laws in the Old Testament have to do with building up the community. You know, things like when you lend to somebody, when the Israelites were lending to another Israelite, they weren't supposed to charge them interest on the loan. After, you know, X amount of years, the loan was actually cancelled. You know, things like that don't make any sense from a making money point of view, but it does make a lot of sense when you're trying to build a community. Okay, last section. Yes, there's an excellent series going around. And that's a picture from that. Give it a promo, the Promised Land. Remember what Amalek did unto thee by the way when ye were come forth out of Egypt, how he met thee by the way and smote the hindmost of thee, even all that were feeble behind thee, when thou wast faint and weary, and he feared not God. Therefore it shall be, when the Lord thy God hath given thee rest from all thine enemies round about, in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it, that thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven, thou shalt not forget it. Yes, it was the occasion where Moses was told to hold up his staff so that the children of Israel could beat back their enemies. That was this particular battle. And what happened there was that it was basically the enemies, or the Amalekites, had sort of more or less fallen upon Israel and attacked them when they were at their weakest. They had just moved into a place where there was not a lot of water, or there was no water, and they'd run out of water. It was where Moses obviously got sick of the people. Maybe it was very hot and everybody was a little bit angry. And so he struck the rock and said, you know, shall we get water out of this rock for you rebels? God didn't like that. And for that reason, Moses didn't actually make it into the Promised Land himself. Very sad. But anyway, while they were all suffering there, the Amalekites struck, and they actually, it sounds like they actually attacked a section of the camp where the women and children were. There's some of the women and children now. Anyway, but the end result was is that Saul was instructed that he should go and destroy the Amalekites. He didn't, and it actually was that he lost his kingship because of that. Anyway, it seems that Haman, who was an Agagite, he was actually supposedly descended from King Agag as well, who was an Amalekite. That's a bit of a side note anyway. All right, got a little bit to go. Let's have a hymn, one that we all should know. I almost left some of the words out on this just to see how good our memories were. But hymn 121, God Moves in a Mysterious Way. Hymn 121, God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. It's certainly one of my favourite hymns. One of those interesting ones that has five verses as well, which is makes it all the more difficult to memorise, but it kind of follows a little bit of a pattern. And so if you get the pattern, it's not so hard to remember which one comes next. But it's certainly, the thing I like about it is it's almost like you defer your own judgment or your own despair or your own, well, a reaction to God, because at the end of the day, he is in control. But what I wanted, the theme I thought that came through for today's chapter is this divine ethic of power and restraint. And I thought it was really interesting that it started out, you know, in that 1-3 where power is given to for justice so that people can actually be held in account. You could say the law has power, you know, the police have power, the courts have power, that sort of thing. And the reason why is because, unfortunately, there is evil in this world and it needs to be held in check. There is, of course, also in this chapter, mutual obligation and interdependence. A statement on that. When we look at people who have wealth or families that are doing really well, they're to make sure that everybody in their family comes along with that. Somebody who's suffered hardship, somebody who's lost a wife, lost a husband, that sort of thing. The community needs to be there to help to build them up. And we have an obligation in that. We saw in Ruth, of course, that that Boaz used his privilege to fulfill his duty. And in that case, God did actually bless them and dignified his response, even though it was somewhat questionable in that he had to marry a Moabitess. We also have economic fairness. Now, when you think about it, when people are in a transaction, there is a sort of a shift of power. You do have somebody who is wanting to sell the goods. While the goods are with them, they have the power. If the person you're selling it to doesn't actually pay the money and they've taken the goods, then all of a sudden they have the power. You know, like there's this whole transaction that happens between us as human beings in everything that we do practically. And so for that reason, we need to have this protection of the weak from predatory power. And hence we have the example of Amalek, who the Amalekites, who actually, they didn't attack the full force of Israel. They went in there to try to white-hand it, I guess you could say, or it was worse than that. It was actually to go and kill off those people that were easy targets. It was a very, very, it was almost like they were unethical even in their warfare. Like there's war, war doesn't mean that there isn't rules. That's, people have an obligation to behave in a certain way no matter what the circumstance. So I wanted to come back to this one because I thought it was rather funny. As I said, I cannot imagine a situation where this would actually happen, and yet here it is described in the law. It's a very interesting. It's a very interesting one, and I think on the right, you know, we've got on the right hand side, we have a particular moment mentioned here where we have the right motive meeting the wrong method. The woman's intention is arguably good. She's gone in there to help her husband, who is obviously having a big barney with somebody else. But she's intervened in such a way which is undignified, I guess you could say, or inappropriate, and actually humiliates the person that they're in an argument with. This is one of the reasons why this is particularly singled out. Not so that when this obscure thing happens, that this is done, but that the principle behind it is that despite the fact that we will have arguments and things like that, we need to do so in a way which basically preserves the dignity of each other. We don't run or belittle people down or dehumanize people just because we don't like what it is that they've done. We need to do things in an honorable way. We need to do things in a way where, a way where we are treating our fellow creature as somebody that is in the image of God. As Jesus says, love your enemies. Consider that in a nation where they were under occupation by Rome. Brutality was the norm. Things were, people were being strung up on crosses and beaten and scourged and all sorts of stuff. It was just not very pleasant. And yet he's going out there saying, you need to love these people. I guess the other thing too is that another thing is that there is a bit of an empower inversion happening there too. If you consider the other thing that was mentioned here as well, the ox and the man driving the ox is an example of a power inequality, where the man obviously has all of the intellect, obviously has all of the skills, I guess you could say, to make this ox do what he wants it to do. But then that's also tempered as well, in that God says, that's fine, this is sure, there are going to be people who are going to be in authority, but that does not mean that you can rule over these people or put them into, put them into any sort of bondage or muzzle them, I guess you could say, in such a way that it takes away their dignity and their freedoms, I guess you could say too. And I think this is an interesting thing. When we actually, as it's got here, Deuteronomy, this particular part of Deuteronomy is kind of almost like a bit of a stress test for all the ideals that are in this chapter. And I'll read these because I thought it was quite a good summary. Protection becomes violation when it disregards dignity. If you, as a parent, for example, go into bat for your child against a teacher or a school or that sort of thing, and you go in such a way that you abuse and you carry on and you say you basically are disrespectful, then irrespective of whether you're right or wrong, you're wrong. You know, you're doing something, it's because you're violating that other person's dignity. As you could see from this, loyalty becomes lawlessness if we start to use shame as a weapon. When we start to disregard that this other person too is in the image of God and needs to be protected. And of course, if there is no restraint, then we're just taking vengeance, aren't we, in the case of justice. And hence the reason why that even in the Jewish justice system, there was a tempering of that. So you can see here that the study of Deuteronomy, the study of the law, and that sort of thing, is more about the law. They're less about the law and more about what's behind it. There's more to it than just what we read on the face of these things. We find that there is the reason behind the reason. We find that there is the spirit of the law. And so I think we need to be very, very careful in our application of instructions like all of these things. If we do so as per the letter of the law, we're likely to miss the point. That's the very danger of these things. And in fact, if you wanted to talk about the reason why we have so many different denominations and so many different churches in our Christian communities, predominantly it's all to do with application, isn't it? We all accept the fundamentals that Jesus Christ came to the earth, that he died on the cross for our sins, and that we have salvation through that. And then we all sort of go, okay, well, what are we going to do from here? But I think the thing is that in my opinion, it's less about what we do and it's more about what those things do for us. Our church teaches lots of things. For instance, many of us keep an hour between 10 and 11 on a Sunday for listening to God, an hour of devotion to God. And we do that irrespective of whether we're at our local church or whether we're out on holidays or whatever. We do this. Why 10 to 11? There's nothing special about that particular time. But the very fact that we have chosen to place God above everything else. That commitment, that time to spend with him, is us making a statement within ourselves that this is something which is the most important thing in our life. Things like, some of us keep our hair. It's not the hair that saves us or anything like that, is it? But it's the fact that it makes us a little bit different and trains us to be not just conforming to the world, and gives us the opportunity, as we've found as well, to preach the gospel of Christ, to go in there and say, this is something that we do for God, and move into whatever it is that we want to tell them after that. The interesting thing about instructions in the Bible, laws in the Bible, is that they have a benefit. There is a principle behind them. There is a benefit that is gained from them. And I think that's really what we all need to prayerfully seek for to work in all of our own lives. Let's leave it there. Oh gosh, we better leave it there. And have our last song, which is Trust in You.
Alright, yes. Oh, sorry, I'm in your way, Chloe. Thank you, Ben. If you'd all like to stand up, we have our last song for today, Trust in You.
Letting go of every single dream, I lay each one down at your feet. Every moment of my wandering, to win this war, I confess. My hands are weary, I need your rest. Mighty warrior, king of the fight, no matter what I face, you're by my side. When you don't move the mountains, I'm needing you to move. When you
take a seat.
Right. Sorry to keep you all in this morning. Didn't mean to do that. Next week, once again, we have service, and I think I'm just going to keep an eye out for a survey that I'm sending around regarding the carols lights put up, and also the maybe a small working bee just to get things in order before we start. Before we start our carols and festive season. Thanks for coming, everyone. We'll see you all again next week.